This is the question and answer period to Paul Hawken, the economist and author of the book The New Great Transformation, which proposes that environmentalism is in fact appearing as a new wave in public consciousness. It was given to the Long Now Foundation on June the 8th, 2007.
You're touring now for your book.
This is the last date of the tour. I've been on the road 4 weeks, city and night almost. This is the last gig, so I am so happy.
All right. Yeah. Then this is the perfect time to ask you. I mean, the genesis story you give for this book is you're out there giving talks on environment and various things, and people come up to you with their business cards, and you start to realize something's going on.
Yeah.
Well, now you've been out on the road with this story.
Right, and people give me a whole bunch of more cards.
I dare say.
I have a whole bunch of them.
But what else? You know, you write a book, and that puts a bunch of ideas in place, and then you go out and you see the book hitting the world and hitting the world. What's coming back to you that, if God forbid you were, you know, doing an epilogue to the book right now, what would you add?
Well, there's a lot of things I would add that I took out, and one of the things, I don't know how many people bought Collapse, okay, and how many people read Collapse? I'm talking about the whole thing. And I know you did. You don't count. But, you know, they call them in the trade goobs, great unread books. In other words, they're great books, but they're never fully read. And there was, when I was writing this, there was so much more information that I left out. One of the things that came to me was a friend collects books that were owned by the Transcendentalists, and he gave me the photostat and a copy, not the original copy, but of a book called Emmanuel of Buddhism, owned by Thoreau, with his annotations on the margins, that was above his head at Walden, in the cabin, you know, and I thought, whoa, you know, I didn't get taught that in high school. And so there's so much, and then he would go to the Emersons for dinner, and they would talk about the Gita, and Emerson just thought it was scripture easily as valuable as and worthy as the Bible, and this is from a Unitarian. So there was a lot of things that I left out that I feel like if I was going to go back, I would do a long addendum, you know. There's a long appendix already, but a long addendum, and I would sort of put in the things that were left out that I just think are fascinating influences, because that goes right back again to the actual age and how it influenced, you know, the Transcendentalists.
Well, the Axial Age had Lao Tzu and Buddha and various people standing up for these things. And you must encounter, when you get an audience of people all pointed at you, and you're saying, you know, this is an amazing movement, but it has no spokesman, and they're out there thinking, is he the one?
I don't think so many people think that. But I'm the one. How many of your parents had read that book, Are You My Mother? You know, and exactly. And if you haven't read it, and if you're a parent, you probably will read it. And it's just about a bird who falls out of the nest and then goes walking around and mistakes steam shovels and automobile ornaments and I don't know what else, tractor or, you know, whatever. But for Are You My Mother? And goes around asking, Are you my mother? And of course, finally, it's united with its mother, and, you know, you want to read it once, but your kids will ask for it every night for, read You Are My Mother. And it's like, but I think everything has a mother, and I think this movement does. And so my role with the book, with the documentary that's coming, and WiseEarth.org, our role in terms of Wise Earth, because I have a lot of staff here, is actually to hold up a mirror and say, hey, you're beautiful, take a look, you know? I mean, that's what that scroll was, which is, because I know many people, when I've traveled, have started to cry when they've seen that, and I thought, well, it is moving, and I think, well, why do they cry? I think they cry because, for two reasons. One is because they've taken on so much of this burden, you know, they feel like they have to save the world, and that it's getting really bad fast, and they're not doing enough, and there's this constant, you know, mining of self and burning out, which is the worst thing. And I think when they see this, there's a sense of relief, like, wow, you know, what I'm doing is adequate? Yes, it's adequate. I mean, it's good enough because you have a lot of you know, kin and kith out there that are working together that you never knew about, you know. And so it's like, are you my mother? It's like being an orphan and finding you have this huge extended family, you know, and that you didn't know about. Yeah.
Since you mentioned it, say a little bit about the documentary in progress.
Well, I think we learn in different ways. I mean, so when the internet is one way of taking information, but it's very different than reading a page of a book. Very different, and yet the words. And why reading off a digital, you know, a screen, why reading off a book? I don't know, but they're different. But so is sound and light. And that's what movie is. I was talking to somebody when I was writing the book, and I said, what makes a great book? And to me, a great book is you want to turn the page. I mean, you don't turn the page, it's not so great. And what makes a great movie is when you're sitting in that place in your chair and you've forgotten your butt the whole, you know, 2 hours, you know. I mean, you don't really feel you're someplace else. You've been transported. And so the movie really is an attempt to go there rather than being just a recantation, you know, of the book or something like that. And it goes into history, I'll be happy to screen it here. You know.
That would be fun.
Yes, that'd be fun.
So, but anyway, cameras, and you are going out to the many organizations?
No,
or
not
what?
Me, no. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do the narrative.
Okay. Know.
The model, people see The Power of Nightmares by Adam Curtis. Anybody see that movie? Brilliant, brilliant BBC documentary. Just exquisite if you can get it. He didn't get permission, so it's not shown here, but it really shows how the U.S. literally created Al-Qaeda. But the use of fear to control us. But it was what's so beautiful about the movie is that he just launched. And when the movie starts, he just launches as a narrative. And there's no pussyfooting around. And you just, oh, there you go. And you're off and running. And that's sort of like the model of Blessed Unrest, which is just ready, go.
Question from Billy Matheson. Out here somewhere. Previous book was The New Capitalism.
Natural Capitalism.
Natural Capitalism. Creating
the Next Industrial Revolution, yes.
This question is this new book Natural Socialism?
Well, Natural Capitalism, you know, the modifier was natural capital. It wasn't capitalism. I coined that term when I wrote the piece. Had a great editor at Mother Jones, Carrie Tremaine, and we were trying to think of a title that would really kind of get under the skin of Mother Jones readers. And so it was Natural Capitalism. But actually, the ism was the modifier, and it was really about what happens when natural capital, which is a term E.F. Schumacher coined, when it becomes a limiting factor to human well-being. And there was this speculation of what would happen, what you could do about it. So this is not about natural socialism, but I don't think socialism really worked, actually. I think the 19th century, the isms were created, the 20th century, they duked it out. And 120 million people died. And now I think we're seeing the end of isms, and they're taking these strange, distorted forms, like neoconservatism and radical religious organizations and economic fundamentalism. But I actually think we're seeing the end. And I think we're moving from a world created by power, a world created by privilege, to a world created by community. And this is a very major transition we're in that I don't think is really totally identified and understood. But it's very, very, it's happening. Jimmy Wales was here, Wikipedia. It's a world created by community, right? And not by privilege. And privilege doesn't like it.
Yeah. Privilege is having to put up with it. It's interesting. here's a pair of related questions. One from Seth Feary, who's here. Thank you. And Kevin Kelly, who's right here. Basically, these are two questions about, here's this great, healthy, health-conserving system. Mm. And Seth Peary asks, I'll put both questions to you, what are the limits to growth for this movement? NGOs compete for funding. Is that a limit? Are there other limits? How big can it get before imploding? One question. Mm. Kevin naturally comes at it from bioscience. If this movement is parallel to the immune system, is there equivalent of an autoimmune disease in this transformation?
Yeah, I love that. I love both questions. The first one I can't answer, though, because it's predictive. I have no idea. And as I said, I won't predict.
Have there been scale issues so far would be one way to think about that.
The scale issues, I think, come in, somebody raised the issue of like transaction costs. It has high transaction costs because there's so much duplication and replication. And I think that's true, but I think that's also true in the human body too, high transaction costs. And so I don't think that is a disqualifier of its effectiveness. In terms of scale, my guess is going to go to 5, 6, 7 million organizations, is my guess. Because I think it's going to be the stroke of midnight for the rest of our lives, and so therefore I think we're going to need each other, and we're going to need to organize in ways. What we see is that people are getting more and more innovative in terms of how they organize that does not depend on very large amounts of money. At the same time, the so-called grantor community is getting very, very innovative in terms of how to transfer small, meaningful amounts of money to groups in need and in a timely way, like Global Green Grants and Kiva.org, which Catherine Fulton talked about. So there's something going on, some symbiosis going on there. In terms of autoimmune is really when, and see, it's interesting because the way I look at it is people look at this and say, well, if it's such an effective movement, how come we're tanking? And a valid question, but the immune system, when it is healthy, lags. There's a real lag to pathogenic invasion, and that lag is called sickness and illness and disease. When there isn't that lag, it's autoimmune. In other words, when the immune system starts, you know, autoimmune, of course, identifies itself as me and or not me, and then it attacks itself. But essentially, you could look at anything that has a lag as being a healthy system. And I would say that doesn't mean it will succeed, by the way. I'm not saying that. But I, when I was writing the book, I did talk to immunologists, I'm sure there's many scientists here and doctors maybe. But as we know, particularly in climate, there's things that scientists will say in private that they will not say in public for obvious reasons. But they're real for them. Just like was it Julie Gallagher actually did the opposite. She's a climatologist and giving a paper to her colleagues, and then at the end of the paper she started to break down. She has a child who's a year old, and she started to weep, you know. And she couldn't keep those two separate. But scientists will say things to you, you know, one-on-one that they won't publish or go on record. And what a couple of immunologists said was, you know, when it gets to that point where you're just so sick and getting sicker and secondary infections are happening, you just feel like it's curtains, you kind of wish it was, you feel so bad, and you actually entertain the thought that you may be dying, there is that moment where the immune system basically turns, that inflection point. And what they were saying is, we actually don't understand what happens at that point. By what we know, it shouldn't happen. It should keep going down, and you should die, or whoever has the disease. And I found that sort of interesting, that there is this sort of Hollywood movement or moment in our bodies, you know, that we can't really understand yet in a scientific way.
This is going to be a question about the singularity. Uh-huh. How it relates to this, and
yeah.
We had Ray Kurzweil here a couple of years ago talking about the singularity. We had Werner Vinge here saying, what if the singularity didn't happen?
Right.
Not likely, but how would that work out? And so the way this question is phrased is, the topic of the singularity comes up frequently at Long Now seminars.
Right.
Do you see the rise of the social immune system as an emergent phenomenon that is responding even now to the incredibly complex social and moral issues that are forming as greatly more intelligent forms of life on Earth arise in this century?
I'd have to ask what the questioner meant by the greatly more intelligent forms of life that are arising in this century. Is he talking about synthetic life? Is he talking about...
You want to say?
It's a fascinating question. I'm not sure I understand the tag.
That was me. That was going into like what Ray Kurzweil wrote in his last book, talking about how human societies, you know, in 100 years are going to be, you know, individuals will be, you know, millions, possibly trillions of times, you know, more intelligent than we are now.
Yeah.
So there's going to be greatly expanded moral issues that we don't even contemplate now.
Right. Got it. Thank you. Yeah. You know, I read Kurzweil's book. I'm fascinated by the fact that he takes 200 different pills every day to keep himself. And I sort of looked at him and thought, he kind of looks like all my friends the same age. But anyway, and in the end, after I read it, I went out to the garden and I just thought, wait a minute, you know, we stand on earth here and the things that are going to determine our lives in the next 100 years are more likely to be soil and water and food and the way we interrelate with each other. And not that I am, you know, against, you know, singularity or some of the things he's imagining so much, is that I think a sort of a basic understanding is lost on all that. And I sort of saw that in the 200 vitamins, the idea that somehow you can, you know, pump all this stuff in there and not just blow your kidneys all to hell, you know, taking 200 vitamins a day, which you do, the kidney just gets so stressed, like, oh my God, what is this, you know? And I just feel like that this movement is really a ground-up movement. And it's not that it's anti-technology, to the contrary. I don't think anybody uses, for example, the internet more effectively than this movement. I mean, it's very effective in use of technological resources. But I don't see it as, in a sense, an anticipation of something that's predicted that hasn't happened.
A couple of questions about the who's in the database. One's from Anonymous. What do you think is the total number of people in all the organizations listed in wiserearth.org and that are implied by...
Implied? The whole... I think there's about 100 million FTEs right now in the world working full-time employees... working every day on these issues, and I would say that's a minimum. Every time that we have made a prediction, given a number, a guesstimate, it's been low. When we hit 150,000, that was 2 years ago at the Long Green. That seemed high, seemed a little, a million seemed really outrageous, seemed kind of like showboating. That's real low, no question about it. It's probably too... And so the 100 million people is a very, very, very fair estimate.
Process advice, always keep that number below what you think it is.
Exactly, I'm trying to, yeah.
You hate right. to, you know.
I want somebody to surprise me. Yeah.
Less than you thought. A question I had is, you said there's surprisingly little contradiction between this wide array, very wide array of you know, in their mission statements and things
in
that.
In the value statements.
Right.
In the value statements.
In
the value statements.
Because no, I would say, you know, there's an environmentalist for nuclear energy group in the UK.
I'm standing next to one. Okay.
They have such a group, but there is such a group. Are they in your, you know, would they be in your database? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
But I'm talking about the values. If everyone agreed, that would be just, well, I mean, who would want to be in a movement like that? That would be death, you know. But I'm talking about the values that inform the conversation, that inform the activity. And you have animal rights people in there, and you have people who are hunters, right? And they both care deeply about habitat and about species, conservation and diversity. But some shoot them and some don't eat them. And yet they're in there together. So there's a quote in the book by Barry Lopez, beautiful quote about we live in a world of contradiction, and without which we would basically, our life would become meaningless without these contradictions. So.
Okay, a final question, building on something that Taryn Norris asked, which is, you describe this movement as coming together, but do you think certain parts of the movement, like some of the fatalism of environmentalism up till now, must first die so that something greater can live? In other words... There's agreement on values, but there's a state change going on.
Right.
There is a transformation.
Yes.
In what ways does the value system itself possibly transform? What needs to get lost for these new things to have the power that they, in fact, want to have?
Yeah, well, I mean, the implication is that there is a value system, and I don't think there is. I think what I'm saying is that the values are rising in every city, country, culture, every indigenous tribe. And when you look at them, what you find is that they don't contradict, but I'm not saying that it's the opposite of, it's like, okay, this is the value system. I mean, when you, there's got to be people here who have started NGOs. When you started it, did you check with anybody to see if you got your mission statement right? You know, that's so preposterous, right? You know you got it right because you worked with people to get it right, and you maybe keep adjusting it. And so there just isn't that kind of uniformity, if you will. Its strength is in its diversity. The fatalism, I think that was in the question about the environmental movement, is understandable in its origins because when you go back 20, 30 years, nobody was listening, and so there was a tendency to keep amping up the story, the narrative, and now the narrative actually, the reality is caught up with the narrative, and so it's not hype anymore, and now they don't know what to say because actually now what you find is them actually tamping down the story, because if you tell really what the true science, not true, but the cutting-edge science on climate change is, now it's so depressing that you kind of lose your audience, so you tend to now do the opposite. So I see that happening, but I also see really because, and this is limited to nonprofits, but you see in here in California, you see this just explosion of businesses and technology and sort of hybrid organizations, you know, venture organizations, venture philanthropy. The line between for and nonprofit is getting blurry, and the ideation and the innovation, the creativity is just exploding right now. And so I don't see it, again, I don't see it as a monolith.
Well, I think there's another change suggested by another question, which I think will be the last. Kevin Braithwaite asks, how do you see this movement changing the role of corporations? What role will they play in this growing community? And I would broaden that and say, what you've talked about is what's going on, what's called the social sector.
Right, social, civil society.
There is still a whole lot of private sector and still right. A whole lot of public sector. So private sector is corporations, businesses, large and small,
right.
Global and local.
Right.
There are governments that haven't gone away and show right. Signs of not going away for some bad reasons, which
no,
you implied, but also some good reasons.
No, we need government. Yeah.
And so in light of this change in their environment, their corporate environment and their governmental environment, what changes are they likely to be having to think about?
Well, it's kind of what I was saying earlier about the things that separated us are becoming really unimportant. Let me give you a couple quick examples. One is the company everyone loves to hate the most, Walmart. When they made their commitment to the environment, which is the real deal, the commitment, and I mean, they're not faking that. They turned to the NGO community, and they didn't let me list them all in the book, but I mean, it's great NGOs. I mean, whether it's Diamonds or Water or Waterless Urinals or, you know, I mean, products or cotton or this, I mean, they turned to the best NGOs and brought them in, and some wanted to be known, some didn't, but that's who they turned to educate themselves, and they still are, you know. Second, a friend of mine who started in NGO, then she worked for Turner Construction to get them to basically change their practices, construction practices, so that there's very little waste. Then she went to work for the city of Seattle on sustainability issues. Now, the U.S. Green Building Council, which is an NGO, consisting of architects, interior designers, manufacturers, government officials, NGOs, who have been dialoguing for years now to create building standards, the LEED standards, you know, silver, gold, platinum, and now creating neighborhood standards for cities, is now paying half of her salary, and she's working with other governments and other people in other cities who the USGBC is also paying half of their salary. So what you're seeing now is a real breaking out of even this movement, as large as it is, it is no longer siloed. In other words, it is not like, okay, there's civil society and there's government. What you see is this amazing fusion and intertwingling, from our friend, but because people need the intelligence. And because governments are so dysfunctional, you're seeing government on the local level really turn to people who have you know, the intelligence, the intellectual capital, and the ideas and the experience, who can basically work and start to transform the cities, way we live. And going back to the talk you gave, you know, really about the importance of cities, and I agree with you that cities are the ecological arcs of the 21st century. It's where humanity, again, in some collective intuitive way, knows to move to the city, to wait it out. It's because where we have the lowest impact on Earth is in the city, and you're getting this amazing Cameron and Architecture for Humanity, and amazing work now on how to reimagine, redesign the city so that they can be places where humans really flourish and our civilization flourishes during a very, very difficult transition in the 21st century. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to a speech by economist and author Paul Hawken for his new book, The New Great Transformation. It was given to the Long Now Foundation on June 8, 2007.